personal development that culminated in Wilder's writing of the novels that secured her reputation as one of America's most popular children's authors becomes evident. Becoming Laura Ingalls Wilder, The Woman Behind the Legend by John E. Miller. The History Book Hour, every night at 9 on Recording Library of West Texas Radio. Read by listening.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 68 and clear. Tonight, partly cloudy with a low in the upper 50s. Then, tomorrow, cloudy with a high in the low 60s. Tomorrow night, it will be cloudy with a low in the mid-50s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 3 p.m.
This is Texas Monthly, the national magazine of Texas. Articles and features read by volunteers and staff at the Recording Library of West Texas.
Texas Monthly for October 2022.
Roar of the crowd. You call the current Texas abortion developments a war against reproductive rights. Many of your loyal readers do not want to be at war with you. Scare tactics. While reading the article, Freedom is Now More Fragile in Texas, August 2022, I was struck by the lack of sources, and the facts seemed to be one-sided views. This commentary piece instead laid out a scare tactic to get people's attention. The recent overturning of Roe v. Wade gave back the power to the states to make decisions. Texas is a conservative state. Now Texas has the power to decide. Victoria Weaver, Fort Worth. Please do not allow your abortion advocacy to devalue your journalistic standards. You speculate rather recklessly. Abortion seeking will possibly be criminalized. Miscarriage could now be a death sentence. Surveillance used against terrorists could conceivably be used at state lines. You call the current Texas abortion developments a war against reproductive rights. Many of your loyal readers do not want to be at war with you. David Stewart, Maybank. I'm aghast at the Texas legislature's magical draconian thinking. Laws making abortion a capital crime, fining anyone who helps a person obtain an abortion, immunity for those who testify against someone seeking an abortion, outlawing contraception. Shall I go on? If a fetus is indeed a person, can a pregnant person claim an embryo as a dependent for a tax deduction? Why not? How about child support? If a fetus is indeed a child, can an unmarried pregnant person sue for child support? Kudos to the pregnant woman in Dallas driving in the HOV lane. Let the payback begin. Carol Park, Lafayette, Colorado. Creative writing. The golden age of Texas fiction, August 2022, had my creative juices flowing like the Guadalupe. I, too, got here as soon as I could, on the coattails of my native Texan husband and the vast volume of information about my new home of San Antonio and the state at large is more than my curiosity can consume. Might Texas Monthly be coaxed into telling its readers more about these universities' prestigious writing programs? and offering delicacies from a selection of each program's successful graduates? I looked, but there was no anthology that I could find. D.A. Gerald, San Antonio. Editor's note. An illustration accompanying the article, A Bunch of Baloney, in the September 2022 issue, erroneously depicted Border Patrol agents operating along the border wall. In fact, the smugglers mentioned in the story were intercepted by U.S. Customs and Border Protection's agricultural team at the El Paso port of entry. Also in the September 2022 issue, a caption in the article Brush with the Past misidentified the artists responsible for the Dream Peace mural in San Antonio. The mural was in fact designed and created by artists with Blue Star Contemporary's Mosaic Student Artist Program. Email us at roar@texasmonthly.com or send letters to Roar of the Crowd, Texas Monthly, Box 1569, Austin, Texas, 78767-1569. Letters addressed to Texas Monthly become the property of the magazine, and it owns all rights to their use. Letters may be edited for clarity and length. TexasMonthly.com. Instagram, Texas Monthly. Facebook, texas.monthly.magazine. Twitter, Texas Monthly. The Texanist, offering fine advice and keen observations since 2007. Question. I just discovered that the Texas Travel Information Centers around the state are no longer flying the Six Flags of Texas, which they did for at least 20 years. I find this to be similar to destroying or removing a historical monument. I was always thrilled to see those flags flying because they represented part of our Texas history. Why have the flags been taken down? Celso Harper, Amarillo. Answer. The Texanist, as any faithful reader of this column knows, is a lover of history, especially the rich and colorful history of the Lone Star State. Anybody who has ever had the pleasure of sitting through a seventh grade Texas history class, as the Texanist did at Temple's Bonham Middle School back in the 70s, go Bulldogs, would surely feel the same way. And this is probably especially so for anybody who had the pleasure of sitting through a Texas history class taught by the likes of the Texanist's teacher, Coach E.A. Boots Simmons. Coach Simmons, who, in addition to handling Texas history, also handled Bulldog football, had some rich and colorful history of his own. As a young man, he was an All-American player at Texas A&M University before being drafted by the Chicago Cardinals in 1943 and then serving in World War II. As imposing a presence at the front of the classroom as he was on the gridiron, Coach Simmons was known to carry a big stick, which he was not afraid to thwack on the desks of sleepy-headed students. Now, the Texanist would be lying if he said that he recalled every detail relating to the Six Flags over Texas that Coach Simmons imparted. But he certainly remembers, thanks in part to that stick, the basics. To wit, the Six Flags over Texas represent the sovereign entities that have laid claim to at least some portion of the place we now call Texas. In more or less chronological order, they are Spain, 1519 to 1685, and 1690 to 1821, France, 1685 to 1690, Mexico, 1821 to 1836, the Republic of Texas, 1836 to 1845, the United States of America, 1845 to 1861, and 1865 to present. And the Confederate States of America, 1861 to 1865. The Texanist should note that the Confederate flag that flew here was the Stars and Bars, which was the South's first official national emblem, not the more familiar and now widely despised Confederate battle flag. Some argue that there should be a seventh flag in the mix, that the short-lived Republic of the Rio Grande, the 1840 effort by Mexican Federalists to separate from Mexico's central government and form their own country, which would have included parts of present-day Texas. While that effort failed, the upstart nation did have itself a fetching standard, which certainly would have made for a handsome addition to Texas' flaggy menagerie, what with its stark design. Two horizontal stripes, white atop black, with a red vertical stripe on the flag's hoist end, marked by an assembly of three white stars. Wow, so dramatic, was the assessment of a colleague who spied an image of the RRG flag on the Texanist desk while dropping by for a sprig of beef jerky. Alas, the RRG never really got off the ground, so its banner has never been granted canonical status. Still others note the omission of any flags representing the indigenous Proto-Texans, who held domain over the region long before Europeans arrived. The Texanist, though, is unaware of either Apacheria or Comancheria having been represented by a specific banner. Arguable oversights aside, the currently accepted array that makes up the six flags does indeed represent much of the grand sweep of Texas history. And that includes not just the most glorious aspects of our past, but also the less glorious and even the downright shameful parts. And this is where the discussion always gets interesting. Though our years as a colony of Spain, France, and Mexico, and as an independent republic are complicated and worthy of ongoing debate, our years as a member of the Confederacy are hard to defend, let alone look back on as a point of pride. The Texanist believes this is so, even though he had ancestors who fought for the Confederacy with the 2nd Texas Partisan Rangers. And while none of us should ignore that era, the question, and it's a fraught one, is how we go about remembering that period without seeming to celebrate it. In your letter, Mr. Harper, you compare the removal of the six flags from the Texas Travel Information Centers to the removal or destruction of other historical monuments. The Texanist assumes you are speaking of monuments dedicated to the Confederacy, which have indeed been the subject of much controversy and removal and destruction in recent years. Well-intentioned Texans will disagree about this, but the Texanist comes down firmly on one side of the debate. Public statuary is not a neutral representation of history. When a statue of some long-gone figure striking a heroic pose is placed on a pedestal in a public spot, that person is, without a doubt, being valorized. And in the case of Confederate generals and the like, we are valorizing figures who committed treason in the name of enslaving fellow countrymen. This is not, one would think, a message that our state would wish to send. The very same reasoning, the Texanist would argue, goes for flags, which by definition are supposed to evoke an ideal and a sense of pride, which is precisely why even the famed Texas-founded amusement park company Six Flags Over Texas did away with the Six Flags back in 2017. We always choose to focus on celebrating the things that unite us versus those that divide us, the company said at the time. As such, we have changed the flag displays in our parks to feature American flags. That said, the official line is that the recent removal of the Six Flags from our travel centers was not prompted by the same considerations. According to the folks over at the Texas Department of Transportation, which oversees the centers, the Six Flags were replaced by the Lone Star flag and Old Glory as a way to save money. The decision to switch to flying just the U.S. and Texas flags was made and approved by then-Executive Director James Bass in 2020, but discussions about reducing the number of flags have been ongoing for several years as a cost-saving measure, agency spokesperson Ryan LaFontaine says. Maintaining Six Flags at many of the state's centers, there are a dozen such facilities, isn't cheap, LaFontaine explained, what with the constant need to repair poles, cables, and the flags themselves. Flying only two flags saves TxDOT as much as $80,000 annually. What's more, the agency says the modification is consistent with flag protocols at the Texas Capitol and at all other TxDOT facilities. As you note, Mr. Harper, the Six Flags have been flown at the travel centers for 20 or so years, which is to say they are a relatively recent tradition, not one that is deeply rooted in Texas culture. The travel centers didn't begin unfurling the Six Flags until many of them were updated in the 90s and aughts. And not all of them flew the Six Flags. The Judge Roy Bean Visitor Center in Langtree and the Capitol Complex Visitor Center in Austin have never done so. Incidentally, Austin's Bob Bullock Texas State History Museum flew the Six Flags in its plaza for about two decades. After a recent renovation, though, it will soon feature only the Lone Star flag and Old Glory. Now, the Texanist would like to say two things about all of this. First, no matter the putative reasoning for doing away with the Six Flags, it's a good thing that the millions of visitors who frequent our travel centers aren't greeted by a symbol of one of our darkest historical periods. The centers exist, after all, for the purpose of creating a positive first impression of the Lone Star State. Second, despite his opinions in regard to the matter, the Texanist doesn't wish to minimize the sense of loss you feel about this change. There is, without a doubt, something bracing about seeing a half-dozen colorful banners majestically flapping in a sturdy breeze. But in a country and a state where the decades-long work of overcoming the legacy of slavery is far from done, the Texanist believes that such sentiments should not be the only ones up for consideration, nor should they be the ones that reign. And for what it's worth, anyone who wishes to view the Six Flags in all their complicated glory may still do so in a somewhat more appropriate setting, that being the Great Hall, a.k.a. the Hall of Six Flags, located in the Hall of State at Dallas Fair Park, home of the State Fair of Texas, where, it is believed, the Six Flags were first popularized during the 1936 Texas Centennial. This year's fair, by the way, runs from September 30th through October 23rd. Thanks for the letter, and happy travels to you, sir. The Texanist is Senior Editor David Courtney. Send him your questions at texanist@texasmonthly.com and be sure to tell him where you're from. Being Texan. Essay. What we say when we say San Antonio. The sounds of wedding bells and blaring car horns. A family outing goes south. By Oscar Cesares. Illustration by Maria Jesus Contreras. When I was 15, and still a year shy of getting my driver's license, my family made the 5-hour drive from our home in Brownsville to my cousin Jimmy's wedding in San Antonio. This was the summer of 1979, and most of us living on the border called the city San Antonio, as it's pronounced in Spanish, and not San Antonio, as I'd heard it pronounced in other places. My parents and I left on a Friday afternoon and stopped along the way at a Whataburger for dinner. My mom had wanted us to eat in the car so we could get to San Antonio before dark because she was well aware of my father's long history of getting lost in any city that wasn't Brownsville. But my mother and I both knew he wasn't going through no drive-thru. My father had a hard and fast rule that no one could eat in his car under any circumstances, especially if it involved hamburgers, which he claimed would leave a lingering stench on the upholstery and our clothes. He wasn't going to show up to Jimmy's wedding smelling like a number one with extra onions. My father was particular about his sage green Oldsmobile Delta 88, which he'd bought used, but treated like he'd driven it off the showroom floor. He washed it by hand every Saturday afternoon, starting with the hood, roof, trunk, bumpers, and taillights, and then spending just as much time scrubbing the tires and white walls with an old horse brush. When he was done drying the Oldsmobile with a chamois, he'd park it under the carport so it would be ready to drive to church Sunday morning. The day before our trip to Jimmy's wedding was the only time I remember him washing it during the week. At the Whataburger, we talked about whether I should apply for a learner's permit that summer, something my mother was in favor of, but my father wasn't sure I was ready for yet. A few months back, he'd taken me to the Brownsville Compress, an industrial park near our house, on a Sunday afternoon, so I could practice driving on the empty roads and parking lots. After a little coaching about where to keep my hands on the steering wheel, we began my first lesson. I shifted into drive, let the car move forward on its own, and focused on not gliding too close to either side. There was a curve in the road before it stretched out for another quarter mile or so and reached the first set of warehouses. I was still coasting along when we spotted an 18-wheeler moving in our direction. "You okay?" my father asked. I nodded, if only because I was concentrating on the unexpected trailer, and nodding took less effort than forming words. I can't explain what happened next. How the Oldsmobile began veering to the left, how it felt like some gravitational pull had taken over the steering wheel, how the truck driver laid on his horn and it made no difference, how my father let out some kind of guttural sound I'd heard him make when his horse wouldn't back up, and how, when that didn't work, he jerked the steering wheel to the right, hard, forcing us onto the shoulder just in time to dodge the oncoming truck and eventually stop in the tall grass near a ditch. He had a few choice words for me, some in English but most in Spanish, none of which are printable in this magazine. Then we switched places and drove home. There would be other lessons, but that was the one that gave him some pause when it came to the learner's permit. People who don't speak the language think it's funny when they learn a bad word or two in Spanish, but in my case, because my father was from El Rancho, meaning the backcountry, and spoke like it, I learned all the bad words in Spanish at the same time I learned all the regular words. Not that he didn't also curse in English. It was just more colorful, poetic almost, when he let loose in Spanish. In our house, it was perfectly normal for us to start a sentence in Spanish and finish it in English, or the other way around, or for one person to stick to Spanish and the other to English. Growing up this way, keenly aware of both languages, and then moving away from the border, I soon noticed some people were saying San Antonio, and others were sticking to San Antonio. Clearly, it's a Spanish name, and no one with any sense of language would argue otherwise. But in this state, a Spanish word isn't necessarily a foreign word, and hearing the city's name said in Spanish is a subtle reminder that we're living in a place that was once part of Mexico. Saying San Antonio is also a way of reclaiming the language that was, until the 60s, banned in Texas public schools, leading to Mexican-American kids being punished in the classroom and on the playground. Even after the ban ended, many of these students were so traumatized they would later opt to not speak Spanish to their own children, and over time, younger generations lost their proficiency with the language. I should also make clear that my parents were sometimes speaking English when they said San Antonio, and if for some inexplicable reason they had woken up the next morning suddenly speaking German or Greek or Swahili, they still would have said San Antonio when it came time to say San Antonio. The hotel where we stayed for the wedding was located downtown. My father pulled the Oldsmobile up to the curb, turned on the flashers, and walked inside to check us in. After he came back out, my mother and I carried the luggage to the elevator while he drove the car into the hotel's parking garage. The plan was to attend Jimmy's wedding on Saturday morning, then the reception at noon, and by mid-afternoon be on the road headed to Houston, where we would visit my sister for a few days before the long drive back to Brownsville. My cousin Jimmy, who now goes by Jim, is technically my first cousin once removed. It was B, pronounced Bea, his mom, who was my first cousin, even though there was an age difference of more than 30 years between us. My dad had been close to her since her father died when she was 12, and later, Bea was living with my parents when she met her future husband, Felix. Being that she was my father's favorite niece, there was no question that we'd be at Jimmy's wedding and reception. The next morning, my father was still getting ready when he tossed me the keys and told me to get the car. He had shaving foam on his face, but from the eyebrows up, it looked like he was smiling, like he'd woken up in a good mood and now trusted me. The hotel's garage was three flights of stairs beneath the lobby and looked abandoned except for four or five other parked cars. I backed the Oldsmobile out of its space and headed up the circular ramp. When I reached the ramp on the first level, I was blinded briefly by headlights coming toward me, but unlike during my driving lesson, I had the sense to just stop in my lane to let the driver pass me by. But then a moment later, in that instant between taking my foot off the brake and wondering how much to step on the gas pedal to go up the ramp, the Oldsmobile lurched backward and smashed into the wall. The sound was worse than the damage, but not by much. The rounded edge of the chrome bumper was dented, and the passenger side taillight was shattered, leaving shards of red plastic on the ground, where I was now standing in the black loafers my mother had bought me for Jimmy's wedding. I managed to quickly pull the Oldsmobile up to the curb and pop the trunk just as my parents came outside. I took the two valises from my father, contorting myself to block his view of the damage as he circled around the back of the car, and my mother moved toward the passenger door. "You brought the car?" he asked me once we were all inside. "You told me to." "I meant for you to ask them at the front desk." "But look, he did it himself," my mother said, all proud, as if I had just aced the parallel parking on my driving exam. He nodded, not looking fully convinced, and tapped on his blinker to make a right turn. We would be eating breakfast first, pancakes, my father had already decided, though he liked to call them hot cakes or panqueques, and afterward, heading to the church. He parked the car facing the front door of the restaurant. Over breakfast, I half listened to my parents talk about wanting to visit with Bea and Felix at the wedding reception, but mainly I wondered how long I could hide the damage. If I could somehow keep my father from finding out until we reached Houston, a good 200 miles away, maybe I wouldn't be blamed for the shattered taillight. Parking wasn't nearly as convenient when we arrived at the church, and my father had to nose into a space that faced the opposite direction, toward I-35, which even on a lazy Saturday morning was way busier than on the one freeway we had in Brownsville. I hustled out of the back seat and again positioned myself at the rear of the car in a way that obstructed my parents' view of the damage. It must have been a lovely wedding, but I wouldn't know, since I spent most of the time looking over my shoulder at the parking lot, hoping, praying even, since we were in a church, for some reckless driver to plow into the Oldsmobile. If my dad had forgotten to lock the door, someone might even steal the car. I wanted to believe that anything was possible, but in the end, when the procession followed the bride and groom out of the church, I couldn't stop my father from peering across the parking lot. "Eso?" he said to me, gripping me by the shoulder.
"What?"
"You know what."
"What is it?"
my mother asked, recognizing his tone.
"Mira," he said,
pointing with his chin, still nicked from shaving. She looked in the direction of the car, her eyes widening as she saw the taillight. And then, just for her, he added, he did it himself. There was a lot more to say on the subject, but there were too many people around for him to let me have it, whether in English or Spanish. And it was also right then that Bea and Felix walked up, and my mother reached out to hug her, and then stepped aside for my father to do the same. Because we didn't have the address or name of the banquet hall, Bea was giving my father directions to the reception when Felix jumped in and said, "Nombre, just follow us so you don't get lost." A few minutes later, my father was still squatting next to the bumper, unscrewing the tiny shattered bulb that had once been part of his taillight when Felix tapped on his horn from across the parking lot and Bea waved for my parents to follow them. Felix looped under the freeway and veered onto I-35. It was only because my father was trying not to lose Felix and Bea in the heavy traffic that he wasn't talking about his busted taillight. We were directly behind them in the passing lane, farthest to the left, when, without so much as signaling, Felix suddenly cut across three lanes and took the exit as if he'd forgotten we were following him. Boxed in by an 18-wheeler, my father hit the horn repeatedly, not for the truck driver, but for Felix, who was now coasting down the frontage road. "Y ahora?" my mother said after a while. "What are you going to do?" We had passed another exit, and my father was still in the left lane, cruising along and looking as calm as I'd seen him all morning. It seemed like he understood things. As hot-headed as he could be, he also liked to tell me that if a problem has a solution, there's no need to worry. And if it doesn't have a solution, you still have nothing to worry about. There was nothing he could do about the wedding reception, as nobody had cell phones in those days. There was also nothing he could do about the bumper. So he was doing the one thing he could do, which was drive. Years later, we'd still talk about the day Felix, without any warning, darted for the exit and left us stuck in traffic. But we never talked about how that same day I had wrecked my father's Oldsmobile. So, yes, in a roundabout way, my prayers were answered. "¿A dónde vas?" my mom asked, wanting to know where my father was taking us. He waited a few seconds and said, "Houston," in English, because that was the only way to say it.
Travel and Outdoors, Guidebook, by Anna Walsh. Tyler comes into bloom. Stop and smell its famous roses, yes, but this East Texas city offers more to enjoy, including a delightful dining scene. In the 89 years since its inception, Tyler's annual Texas Rose Festival has been suspended only twice, during World War II and in 2020, the first year of the coronavirus pandemic. Held the third weekend of October, the celebration includes a parade and the crowning of a debutante-style queen whose custom gown is bedecked with crystals and jewels and features a long train that alone can take months to construct. The festivities continue to be a major draw to this area, which once grew more than half the country's supply of rose bushes. While still an industry powerhouse, it's now better known for processing the blooms, mostly from other states, than producing them. But there's more to the self-proclaimed rose capital of the world than its flowers. Located about 100 miles southeast of Dallas and boasting a population of around 106,000, Tyler, which benefited greatly from the 1930 discovery of the East Texas oil field, mixes small-town friendliness with a growing cultural scene and dining options that can hold their own against those in Texas's biggest cities. Guidebook, Dine and Drink, After enjoying breakfast and a pour-over coffee at the Airy Cafe 1948, located on the Tyler City Square, grab one of its cold-pressed juices. For lunch, try the baby back ribs or meaty sandwiches at Stanley's Famous Pit Barbecue, which has consistently made Texas Monthly's top 50 list since 2008. The decor may be a bit unassuming at Culture EXT, but Chef Lance McWhorter's sophisticated menu draws inspiration from East Texas and around the globe. For dining al fresco, get a table on the patio at Grove Kitchen and Gardens, where Chef Arturo Lara serves dishes including ahi tuna crusted with togarashi. At the Black Pearl, the affable bartenders can mix a craft cocktail from the menu or concoct something to your specifications. See and do. Gawk at the bespoke bordering on campy gowns of past festival queens and court members at the Tyler Rose Museum before taking a meditative stroll through the adjacent 14-acre Tyler Municipal Rose Garden, where, during the peak seasons of October and May, floral hues include dusty pastels and rich jewel tones. Nearby, Tyler State Park offers a spring-fed lake and hiking trails through the pines. Take a guided tour of the Victorian McClendon House, the childhood home of the late firebrand Sarah McClendon, one of the first female reporters to cover the White House, which she did for some 50 years. While Rick's on the Square has hosted live gigs, the local music scene has grown, with shows at Stanley's and both locations of True Vine Brewing Company. Shop. Inhale the fragrant air at Moss, near the Square, as you peruse the flower shop's collection of darling plant paraphernalia, dried floral, and greenery wreaths and gifts. Velvet, on the same street, offers a well-curated collection of vintage furniture and clothing. Stay. The modern but cozy Thomas Hotel, which opened in August on the Square, features 8 nicely appointed suites. For a rural retreat, make the 20-mile drive to High Hill Farm, complete with a picturesque vineyard and cozy bungalows.
Style and Design. Obsessions by Emily McCullough. Photographs by Jackie Lee Young. We Quilt This City.
Reading time, 19 minutes.
After a year of solitary pandemic quilting, devotees of East Texas fabric mothership, Stitch in Heaven, take over Fort Worth, ready to bond and spend. Quilting is a slippery slope. At first you think, I don't need that $1,000 sewing machine. The $200 one will be just fine. You swear you'll never start a new quilt before finishing the one you're already working on. You believe with your whole heart that you, a practical hobbyist, will never buy more fabric than you absolutely need. But then you take a quilting class, and for an afternoon your anxious mind is lulled by the meditative hum of a high-end Bernina machine. The next thing you know, you have 2 dedicated sewing rooms, 4 separate machines in operation at any given time, and a dream to build a newer, bigger house with more cabinet space for the fabrics you don't yet have uses for, but they were too pretty not to buy. The busload of women who descended upon quilt country one morning this past spring were not newbies. They had long ago cast aside naive notions about low budgets. They had come to the specialty shop in Louisville, 40 miles northeast of Fort Worth, prepared to indulge. We're like ants running to a piece of watermelon, said Mary Haney, a 57-year-old grandmother of 7, as she lined up to disembark from the charter bus. Her hair was short and spiky, and she wore a hot pink fleece pullover with patches of blue gingham for flair. Mandy Weaver, also 57, is a design engineer who dreams of retirement, mostly so that she can devote herself to quilting full-time. She joked about the local news story that might result from a stampede of quilters. It could get tight by the sale table, she warned me. The ladies had come to Quilt Country in April as members of Land Ahoy, a cruise organized by Stitch in Heaven, a massive quilting hub in the East Texas town of Quitman that includes a store, a retreat center, and even lodgings for its customers. The Fort Worth event was the third of five since the coronavirus pandemic began, following meetups in Orlando and Nashville, and preceding ones in Las Vegas and San Diego. Though few of the quilters had met before the retreat began, and though they had come from all over the country, just a few days into the trip, there was no indication that participants had known each other for less than a week. A few of the 36 attendees had stayed behind at the group's home base, the Fort Worth Embassy Suites. All the quilters were women. The only men present were a Stitch in Heaven employee and three tag-along husbands. Most of the seven-day retreat was spent quilting back at the hotel, but the visit to Quilt Country was the crown jewel of what event organizers called Excursion Day. The store's exterior was nondescript, a bleak module in a strip mall on the side of a Metroplex highway. The rainy weather gave the vast, empty parking lot a tepid aura. But Quilt Country's more than 6,000-square-foot interior, which held some 9,000 different fabrics, all arranged by designer, style, and color, was a brave new world. To cross the threshold was to be transported to a space as vibrant as a Parisian flower market in springtime. "Yay!" Mary chirped as soon as her feet hit the pavement. She and the rest of the quilters all but sprinted into the shop. Pausing briefly to take the 20% off coupons, employees were passing out at the front door. As promised, Mandy headed for the sales section, though she did stop by the blue batik fabrics, where her denim pants and chambray blazer almost camouflaged her. Christina Hollis, an Air Force veteran and one of only two land cruise attendees younger than 50, started to skip toward the first display table she saw, piled with kaleidoscopic bundles of pre-cut fabric. It was a quilting supermarket sweep. The shoppers were calling out jargon no layperson would understand. "Oh, here we go! License plates!" exclaimed Christina, having discovered some collectible patches unique to every quilting shop, with which one can make a quilt commemorating all the places they've been. "The fat quarters are over here," Mandy said, pointing to crates of roughly 18 by 21 inch fabric swatches, which the quilters would use like poker chips during a game later that night. Things calmed down a bit in the store's back room, where there were chicken salad croissant sandwiches for lunch. While the women ate, one of the store's employees gave a demo of a tool that would allow the quilters to create a mariner's compass, a notoriously complicated but popular pattern, with ease. When the presentation was over, the quilters discussed their purchases. Mary told one of the retreat's instructors about the purple sunflower pattern she knew she had to have as soon as she saw it hanging on the wall in the shop. Mandy and Christina, each carrying multiple full shopping bags, lamented the rising cost of fabric. "You used to be able to get it for 10 cents a yard," joked Mandy, who started quilting in the early aughts. "Now it's $12. When it was time to climb back into the black pleather seats of the bus, Amy, one of Stitch in Heaven's event coordinators, shouted, "Raise your hand if you spent over $100. Almost everybody shot up a hand. Amy began increasing the sum in increments of $50, and by the time she got to $300, the bus erupted in laughter and cheers for the two quilters who still had their arms in the air. Before we'd set out for quilt country, a button-nosed woman named Phyllis Moynihan had joked that quilting is a dangerous game where whoever dies with the most fabric wins. Phyllis did not join us on our excursion. Pam Sawal, 64, bemoaned her cabinets upon cabinets full of fabrics she knew she'd never use. She had signed up for the Fort Worth event after having so much fun on the Orlando land cruise in February. "When I die, it'll all still be there, I'm sure," she admitted. That quilting can get very expensive very quickly bodes well for Stitch in Heaven, whose offerings go way beyond fabrics, patterns, and tools. The quilt cruises, which cost between $1,499 and $2,499, are just one arm of the company, whose approach to business Inc. magazine called a master class in the wooing, winning, and retention of customers. Founded as a small shop in 1996 by Deb Luttrell, Stitch in Heaven has grown into a mega brand with millions of dollars in annual sales. Deb originally moved to Quitman from Fort Worth, planning to break into emu ranching. Quilting was her backup plan. To draw visitors to a small town in East Texas, Deb has positioned Stitch in Heaven to be as much a gateway to a quilting community as a fabric mecca. Besides a thriving online trade and a 17,500-square-foot store, Stitch in Heaven boasts a calendar packed with well-attended events. In a town of about 1,900, the business employees 70. In non-pandemic times, Stitch in Heaven's land cruises are cruises, each attended by up to 90 quilters. The company's next scheduled voyage in the Caribbean is set for late January. Proof of vaccination will be required for all attendees. "We were doing 15 cruises a year before the pandemic," Deb told me over the phone. The small-statured Spitfire, who has a piney woods twang and feathery platinum blonde hair, is a fixture on the sea cruises. She'd visited Fort Worth's Land Ahoy retreat but left the day before I got there. Instead of crying into our beers, we pivoted. With a no-sail order from the Centers for Disease Control in place for cruise ships, Stitch in Heaven swapped conference rooms and cabins on Royal Caribbean ships for space at hotels in quilt-friendly cities across the country. Deb said they looked for locations that had quilt shops and exhibits or other activities that may be interesting to quilters. In Fort Worth, the quilters also visited the National Cowgirl Museum and Hall of Fame. While quilt country is hardly as exciting as a batik factory on the Caribbean island of St. Kitts, the quilt cruise regulars seemed ecstatic to be back in the mix. Like me, many attendees were delighted just to be out of their houses after a year of pandemic inactivity. Stitch in Heaven follows the COVID-19 safety protocols of host hotels and encourages social distancing. By the time I arrived, on the fourth day of the week-long event, the party was in full swing. The women were working diligently on two quilts of valor, the patriotic patterns that were the focus of the retreat. At the hotel, a fifth-floor conference hall dubbed Synergy One hummed with the buzz of the quilters' chit-chat and the steady tap of about 40 brand-new Bernina sewing machines. There was a machine for each quilter, as well as a few used by the instructors and staff. This wall of sound was occasionally breached by someone's hearty belly laugh, or a pfft from the top-of-the-line steam iron at the center of the room. The sky outside was dark and stormy, which made the fluorescent lights seem brighter. Fabric covered every surface, the workstations, the cutting table, the ironing areas, and even the mingling zone where an unfinished jigsaw puzzle lay. The room was scattered with rattan baskets, each filled with chocolate candy and mini bottles of Sutter Home White Zinfandel. Some of the quilters worked barefoot. Others wore shoes with thick, cushy soles and pants with soft waistbands. They sported T-shirts with motivational messages like, "Pray about it, girl," and "I make pretty things." The dress code was simply, "Get her done." And they did. By day five, both Mandy and Mary had finished the first quilt pattern, the wave, an intricate design of meandering strips of red, white, and blue fabric that used a centuries-old method of blocking called the drunkard's path. They had begun working on the second quilt, a hollow star, an equally ambitious contemporary pattern involving multiple six-pointed stars. Some women had moved on to passion projects they had brought with them from home. The quilters were committed, many arriving at Synergy One as soon as it opened at 8 a.m. and staying until almost midnight. They occasionally stepped away from their work to admire each other's progress and help those who might be stuck. Karen Tapking, an experienced 72-year-old quilter from Utah, gently informed Pam that her pieces were slightly misaligned. "I wanted you to know before you started sewing," Karen told a thankful Pam. At the other end of the workroom, Christina got down on the floor with Lonnie Carver, a 67-year-old Louisianan, as the latter pieced together her quilt. During the pandemic, when many Americans turned to crafts as a distraction and for a practical application of their idle hands, the quilters were in their element. So was Stitchin' Heaven, whose profits shot up 60% last year. Douglas Tapking, who had tagged along with his wife, proudly bragged that Karen had made 55 quilts since the lockdowns began. And though quilt making is on the surface a solitary activity, one person working with one needle and one thread at a time, it is historically a deeply social art form. The skill is passed down from mothers to daughters. There were two mother-daughter pairs on the Fort Worth land cruise. And the quilts are passed down, too. My family still has a quilt that was made by my great-grandmother. Karen didn't make 55 quilts for herself, after all. Lois Herrick, a retiree who was wearing a crimson Stitchin' Heaven T-shirt that read, "Quilting is not a hobby, it's a lifestyle," has been on 9 quilt cruises. She was on her way back from a cruise in the Western Caribbean in early 2020 when the world began to unravel. "We came back on March 14th, she said. "We didn't know if we would be able to get off the ship." Lois and a friend had planned to stay for 2 weeks in Florida, where they were docked, before boarding another cruise, but they'd had to cancel. The rest of the year was a doozy. Lois, who was then recovering from her second hip replacement, generally felt isolated in her home in Mustang, Oklahoma, where she lives alone. When she was able to travel again, she didn't hesitate to book a spot on the closest land cruise. When we met, she was working on one of the two quilts featured on the retreat, or, if she felt like it, a forest green project she was hand-quilting just for kicks. I often saw her sitting at the puzzle table, chatting. "It's about relationships more than just the quilting," The camaraderie is just so important to these ladies, Deb Luttrell said. And they love it. They love to sew, and they love to be with people who have a shared interest. For many of the quilters I met, Land Ahoy was just one of the quilt-centered social activities on their calendars. Some, like Mandy Weaver, were members of local quilt guilds, volunteer organizations that provide handmade quilts for those in need, while others find community in Facebook groups or go on annual quilting trips. Even to a non-quilter like me, the conviviality was appealing. The quilters welcomed me into the fold, inviting me to join them on walks around downtown Fort Worth and to eat with them at breakfast. They tried hard to get me hooked on their shared hobby, and by my second night, I was well on my way. Soon I was oohing and aahing over the beautiful fabric swatches we were using as currency during game night. I wasn't the only newcomer having a blast. Christina, who was on her first quilting retreat, was surprised by how motivated she was by the group. I wouldn't be doing this at home, she said of the Quilt of Valor, which was slightly above her skill level. At home, I would be struggling and cursing. Here, I have support. She didn't want to miss out on any more retreats either. She was already joking about how to break it to her husband, who she suspected would be less than thrilled when she returned from one expensive quilt vacation with plans for many more. But that's quilting for you.
Thank you for joining us for Texas Monthly, the national magazine of Texas, read by volunteers and staff at the Recording Library of West Texas. You can hear this program on demand with your favorite device at recordinglibrary.org. Next, on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, Travelin' Texas, followed by Texas Gardener at 4:30.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 71 and clear. Tonight, partly cloudy with a low in the upper 50s. Then, tomorrow, cloudy with a high in the low 60s. Tomorrow night, it will be cloudy with a low in the mid-50s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 4 p.m.
Hello and welcome to our program. My name is Lynette McGlamory, and I'll be reading Travelin' Texas here on Sight and Sound Radio. For today's program, I'll be reading articles from the January issue of Texas Highways, and I'll start out with the editor's note by Emily Roberts Stone. Ramble on. Each January, our staff takes time to set travel resolutions for the year ahead. This year, I'm looking forward to introducing my family to Palo Duro Canyon State Park. While I've visited twice now, the rest of my family has yet to view the majestic vistas of the country's second largest canyon. Here's where some of our other staff members are heading. Tyson Bird, Digital Strategies Manager. My parents recently sold their house and became full-time RVers. In their travels around Texas, they speak most highly of their time in East Texas, specifically the Big Thicket, a place I've never gotten to see. This year, I hope to finally explore that part of the state for myself. Julia Jones, Associate Editor. Of all the places I haven't been in a while, I miss the coast most. When I have a free weekend, no matter the season, I hope to take a road trip to Padre Island National Seashore to smell the fishy air and hang around with the wildlife that calls the beach home. Danielle Lopez, Senior Editor. This year, I plan to reach the very top of Texas, Guadalupe Peak. My best friend, Rachel, and I take an annual trip to West Texas, historically in the Big Bend area. But this year, we want to head further north to Guadalupe Mountains National Park. It's a difficult hike that climbs nearly 3,000 feet, and I'm not a big hiker, so I'd better get to training. Who wouldn't want to see Texas from up above? and finally Sarah Thurmond, web editor. I recently traded in my old car for a new one and am looking forward to gathering a few friends and taking road trips in it. We plan to check out towns we've never visited and stay at newly renovated historic hotels, like the Crazy Water Hotel in Mineral Wells and the P.A. Smith Hotel in Navasota. So, where are you headed this year? Share your travel resolutions at letters@texashighways.com. And now, here's the feature article for this month's Texas Highways 2023 Travel Bucket List. Mark your calendars and gear up for a year's worth of Texas adventures. There's never a shortage of options for new escapades across the largest state in the lower 48. With Texas's bounty of landscapes, people, foods, and cultures, it can be hard to know where to begin. To provide a little travel inspiration for your new year, we've chosen a bucket list activity for each month. Find old treasures shining anew, artistic happenings too exciting to ignore, and fanfare in unexpected places. While the square mileage of our state might make hitting all 12 a challenge, this is Texas, and we've got to dream big, right? January. Write your name on the desk at Hancock Hill in Alpine. Long before virtual school became commonplace, a remote learning had an entirely different meaning in Alpine. Searching for a quiet place to study in 1981, three Sol Ross State University students decided to lug an old metal desk and chair up the slopes of Hancock Hill, directly behind their dormitory. Under the blanket of the West Texas sky, with picturesque views of the Chihuahuan Desert, their new learning space soon became popular for hanging out and meditating. As time passed, visitors scribbled names, anniversary dates, poems, and thoughts, both profound and meaningless, throughout the desk's battered surface and inside notebooks kept within the drawers. The original desk is gone after years of bathing in the sun, but the university replaces it once each desk's surface is filled. Today, guests still eagerly trek the 1.8-mile loop trail with pens and markers ready to leave their signatures behind. Navigating the hike is made easy with printed and digital maps. But if you get lost, don't worry. The fabled desk isn't far from another of the hill's peculiar landmarks, a tree with bicycles dangling on its branches. February. Sip on ancient spirits in Roma. A new Texas agave distillery has taken root in Roma, on the edge of the Rio Grande Valley. Ancestral craft spirits is the product of Leonardo Sanchez and his business partner, Eduardo Ocampo, whose family first settled in Roma 8 generations ago when it was still a Spanish territory. Located on the border town's historic square, the distillery is a natural fit for an area so evocative of the Wild West that director Elia Kazan shot the movie Viva Zapata among its wrought iron balconies and adobe facades. When Ocampo and Sanchez, mezcal distributors from Mexico, learned agave varieties can be cultivated in Roma, they resurrected a hacienda-style two-story brick building that had been the town's general store in the late 1800s. Now, its neatly raked gravel courtyard is home to agave plants and monthly gatherings with music, barbecue, and, of course, samplings of their first batch of agave spirits called Blasphemous, with an F. The beverage is akin to mezcal, though only spirits distilled in Mexico can technically be called that. Bringing fresh life to Roma's charming but crumbling square, Ocampo and Sanchez plan to open a vacation rental to host agave-loving travelers because some libations are worthy of a pilgrimage. March. Explore the Galapagos Islands at the Houston Zoo. The Houston Zoo's latest exhibit transports visitors to the Galapagos Islands, the archipelago 600 miles off the coast of Ecuador, made legendary by Charles Darwin's On the Origin of Species. The exhibit offers an exploration of the island chain's singular flora and fauna, with lessons in evolutionary biology and the survival of ecosystems shared along the way. Though the animals of the Galapagos are protected, the Houston Zoo has brought in substitute, quote, animal ambassadors. The sea lions, penguins, sharks, and